Hi folks, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the latest podcast from the Banter team. One of the questions which comes up again and again at different Banter discussions is to do with who sets the news agenda. Be it a general election or Syria, people are genuinely curious about why certain stories make the mix, the filters which are used to make these decisions, and the stories which don't make the cut as a result. This Banter discussion at Wigwam in Dublin brought together Susan Daly, editor of the Journal, Richie Oakley, editor of the Times Ireland Edition, and Vincent Murphy, editor of Morning Ireland on RT Radio 1, to talk about their work, the decisions they make, the factors which inform these decisions, and other issues around the editorial process.
Hi everybody, welcome along here to Banter number 132 at Wigwam. This used to be a techno dungeon. It still is occasionally. It used to be kind of like sweat coming down the walls, people taking yokes left, right and centre. And now we're here back in. This was one of the places we did Banter in before when this venue was called Twisted Pepper. This is our first time back here as well, so it's good to be back home. It's where it all began. My name is Jim Carroll and tonight it's the news agenda. We're joined by three well-practiced, well-travelled, experienced news hounds. We've got Susan Daly here, who's the editor of the Journal. Over here we've got Richie Oakley, who's the editor of the Times Ireland Edition. And next to him we've got Vincent Murphy from RT Radio 1's Morning Ireland, the editor of Morning Ireland. Please give them a round of applause. So a little bit of housekeeping. We'll talk for about 40, 45 minutes and then there'll be just a break so you can get some fresh air and the bars upstairs as well. And then you come back for the second part, which will just be a Q&A. So if you have any questions, that's the second half of the show. Just going to start by asking each one of you, just give me a kind of a, Richie, starting with you, give me a potted CV. How did you end up at the Times Ireland Edition?
Well, I suppose I edited a college newspaper, got a placement in the Sunday Tribune, refused to leave, was there for 5 years, got asked to join the Sunday Times in 2003. I was there as a political reporter, I was a deputy news editor, motoring correspondent, and then I developed and launched the Sunday section, which is the lifestyle section in the Sunday Times. Did that for 3 years, and then I developed and launched the Ireland edition of the Times, which is the first 6-day digital newspaper in a 7-day package with the Sunday Times. And then I was lucky enough to be appointed editor of that, and I've been doing that since we launched in September, and you can get it for €5 a week, and we give a free iPad if you do an 18-month subscription.
Excellent. We charge you for that later on. So, Vincent, what were you doing before you became one of the editors at Morning Ireland?
Yeah, so similar to Richard, I studied journalism in DCU, graduated in the late 90s, got a placement in the Sunday Tribune, didn't stay there, went to...
Did Vincent Brown kick you out?
Or was it? No, it was after his era. Matt Cooper was the editor at that stage. In 2000, I started working for an organisation now defunct called Independent Network News. It provided like local radio stations around the country with the national and international news. Worked there for 7 years till 2007. Like Bertie, it was all grand when I left, but it closed down not too long afterwards. Joined RTE in January 2007. Worked there as a kind of a newsreader on 2FM and then a reporter with Morning Ireland from late 2008. Actually, the Sunday after the bank guarantee was my first shift on Morning Ireland as a reporter, and then worked there until the end of 2009, took a 2-year career break, went to New York, worked there for a while as a freelancer, came back to RTE in January 2012, and in around about this time of the year, in 3 years ago, I was appointed one of the editors of Morning Ireland.
How many editors does Morning Ireland have?
So the structure of Morning Ireland, there's a series editor. His name is Shane McElhattan. He's the kind of in charge of the ship. And then there are three programme editors, and we're in charge of putting together the day-to-day programmes. It's unusual in the sense that because of the hour in which the programme goes out, we need an editor on duty in the morning while the show is going out, but obviously most of it is prepared the night before. So one editor will do a kind of a 12-hour shift the day before, and then another editor will be in at 5 o'clock to make sure it goes out all right, and because of the hours and stuff, that's why there's three of us to share the rota.
Okay, excellent. And Susan, yourself, what's your career path been like before you took over the Journal?
Yeah, a little bit eclectic. Started as a teacher, but was writing at night time for newspapers.
What were you teaching?
French and English. Right. Please don't ask me anything in French because I'm appalling. Actually, 2 weeks ago, we had to ring something in France and I was like, does anyone speak French? And they were like, you do. I was like, don't. So really bad at that. But it was good at the time. At night time, was writing sports for the Evening Echo in Cork. And the Examiner as well, and then moved to Dublin, forgot about the teaching and carried on doing freelance up here, moved to the Daily Star, the Irish Daily Star, and worked across a bunch of different things. It was really good training in that way. Also learned some other things that you wouldn't necessarily learn in journalism school. It was quite amazing. But worked across there, starting in sport, but eventually moving across to news, which is where I'd wanted to go. Ended up assistant editor on the startup of the Star Sunday. Also now defunct. It seems to be something we have in common with Sunday papers going down the tubes. I didn't break it, I think, but that's what happened there. Then moved down to the Daily Star properly for day news editor and was there for a while, then went to the Indo, and then the Journal came calling in a sort of weird way. Somebody got appendicitis. There was a job freeze going on with the Indo, which is an interesting sort of situation at the time, considering how much hiring is going on in the industry at the moment. I just started doing things within the Journal, took over as deputy editor, and 6 months after that became editor, and it's been kind of 5 years since then, so that's as old as we are, and I came in about a week after the Journal started, so I've seen it change quite a bit since then. It's been interesting.
Okay, excellent. So as you can see from that, there's a kind of a wide range of experiences, a wide range of kind of, I suppose, different titles represented up here, and let's look at how each one of you have kind of, like, I suppose, dealt with one story that's been constant for the last while. I mean, Vincent, you've been away for the last couple of weeks, and before you went away, you kind of said to me, if it hadn't happened in the meantime, Jim, if it hadn't happened, I can't talk about it, and like, you kind of give the example of the government, and you went away on holidays. 3 weeks later, we still haven't got a government. So I'm kind of interested as how the three of you, like, I mean, Morning Ireland, The Times Ireland, and The Journal, are keep that story fresh. You know, keep that story, which is like to an awful lot of people, it's just a bunch of lads in blue suits going into Trinity College every day and coming out again at the end of the day, having talked about nothing. Well, like, talk about the challenges maybe of keeping the story like that fresh and appealing to readers all the time, or listeners all the time.
I mean, it's very hard, and. You know, if you guys are bored with it, you can't imagine the people who are working every day and keeping an eye on it every minute of every day, how bored we are of it. But the alternative is you just let them do these negotiations in a room, and we don't, and you come out at the end with the deal done. So our job in the media is to make sure that we are keeping an eye every day on what they're doing, and we are telling you where the stumbling blocks are and what little things. And yeah, of course it's repetitive. It can be boring, but it's important stuff. And what's more important than the formation of the government of the country? I mean, at the end of the day, any of us who work, you know, half an hour out of every hour that we work is for the government, because the money goes in tax to the government. And you know how that's spent. We all have parents, elderly, waiting on hospital trolleys. We all have mortgages. You know, so it's real life stuff. It's very important stuff. And it's, you know, how do you keep it fresh? You know, what's the nuance today? Where's the nuance tomorrow? Where is it going? Who can tell us that's inside that room? What can we find out? That's all you can do. It might be boring.
So, what about the Journal?
Yeah, well, I think that we kind of look at it, probably approach it in three different ways at the moment. I suppose one is that, as Vincent's saying, you can't kind of ignore that it's happening, because occasionally people will come in and go, well, I haven't looked at it in 3 days, but lads, that's your job. So the fact that you're not carrying a story on it is quite disappointing. But we had to put a structure on that. So we will have a story in the morning based on what Christina Finn, we have a full-time reporter down there all the time at the moment, chatting to people coming in and out, trying to find out what's happening so that we have some good information on that. She'll have something there in the morning, and then we'll update it only with important lines during the day, but we don't scattergun the site with lots of stories about it. But we think it's kind of good to have that consistent check-in for people. So there's that. Then there's the other side of it where you go, let's just think about how people are just experiencing the fatigue of it, and not least ourselves, like bored to tears by the whole thing on one level, while understanding the impact of not having a government. And so we would have run a story. It's not a story, of course, it's just a post, explaining the things that had happened quicker than at the time that we wrote it. Was the 54 days of negotiations, one of which was the siege of Constantinople had been and gone in this time, and these people cannot get their heads together. I mean, that kind of thing. So look, you can have a bit of fun with it as well, just to reflect, guys, we know how you're feeling. But then the third part of it is to try and come at it with, what is the impact of this? What is falling between the cracks while the civil servants try to keep things chugging? One of the stories that's very interesting, because when we're talking here about who sets the news agenda, it's not just us. It is also about what people want to read and show their interest in. And our stats are really transparent. You can actually see how many people are reading a story at any given time. That story about what was happening in the courts in regards to people being out on suspended sentences and whether they could be recalled and whether that was all gone by the wayside because of this judgment last week, there was actually very little public interest in that, simply because it was quite dense, you know, and it's about mechanics and so on. But if you can bring it back to what this means, it means that, A, this guy could be walking down the street even though he should be back in jail or not, which it turns out actually wasn't the case necessarily. Like, we shouldn't scaremonger about it. But it actually took a lot to get people interested in it. So that's a kind of a very delicate balance, trying to figure out what people want to read or what they will read, what you're wasting your time on. And then you're kind of sense as a journalist that, lads, you should be reading this, but not want to shove it down their throats. But even, I suppose there are other things then. Stuff is still going on in the chambers in the Dáil. Last night there was... you know, this thing going around on social media that there were only 10 TDs had turned up at this debate on mental health, which is a complete disgrace, obviously. And we looked at it and we said, you know, did the initial thing of a lot of people are quite angry that there doesn't seem to be many people in the chamber. But then we checked ourselves, actually, like we're fact-checking ourselves as much as anyone else, and checked into what people are getting outraged about. And we're trying to put a bit of narrative on what's happening. And the truth was, actually, that there were 33 TDs stood up and spoke, and there were 28 in attendance who didn't speak. And, you know, also trying to explain the structure of the Dáil debate. So I do think that there's a load of different angles you can come in at it. And it's almost like sort of trying to sometimes, a bit like sneaking veg into a baby's food. I'm at that stage in life, just so you know. You're trying to get people to understand why it's important without telling them this is fucking important,
Yeah. I mean, I want to come back to that thing about the sculpting the news and how it changes during a day, and like how you may like may change the weight and balance of the story. But turn to you, Richie. You mean, like, you know, obviously Vincent is doing, you described it very well earlier on. You were saying, like, well, you know, like in Susan's case, they're updating the site all day. In Vincent's case, it's rush hour radio. You know, you have to get it right. Yeah. In your case, there's one edition only.
Yeah, we're kind of unique. But first of all, for me, the politics situation we have at the moment is absolutely fascinating. I don't find it boring whatsoever. The reason I find it fascinating is because I think in Ireland we get way more detail of how political decisions are made. We're close, the reader is close to getting an experience of someone sitting in at that, because political journalists, like we have Niamh Lyons, she can get on to the people at that meeting. She won't tell you who exactly she's talking to, but she will get you detail from that meeting. And I think if you look at politics in Britain, it's very much broad brushstrokes. I think in Ireland that we have a very unique ability to understand our politics. So for me, this process is fascinating. This is the government formation talks that people voted for. This is it. People voted for instability. They had a very clear choice of Fine Gael and Labour. They rejected it. These talks are always going to happen, and we have to follow them through to see what comes out at the end and what gets washed out in the back of it. So that process, I think, is really fascinating. For us, we almost operate like a Sunday on a daily basis, in that we don't update the website at the moment. We don't do any breaking news, and we ultimately we sometimes ignore breaking news story, because for us, what we're trying to do is we're trying to do a morning edition, a set number of stories, a product that people can come to and get all the information that they need to kind of catch up on. It also, it's aimed, it's kind of a luxury product, we feel, as well, so that it's a moment that people will take out of their time the next day to read. I don't know if any of you have it on your iPad or whatever, but it's a very unique product compared to a newspaper, and it is very high-end, the experience of actually reading it. So that's what we're trying to do. So you might see reporters these days at conferences or at things. They're tweeting. Some of them are trying to take photographs. Some of them are trying to report straight away and get them up. None of my reporters are doing that. They're sitting there. They're taking it all in. They're looking at who's required, because they don't have a deadline until 6 o'clock in the evening. They don't have to post anything up online. They don't have to run the newsroom through their Twitter account. And we find that's getting us a lot of stronger stories that we can stand over as agenda setting stories, or if not agenda setting, agenda explaining stories. So even in the last 2 days, say on Monday, we also can use the guys in the Sunday Times, and the benefit for them now is if they have a story that's not going to hold till Sunday, they can turn around and give it to us in the Daily. And that's how we had the report. We were the first people with the report on the Alan Shatter and McCabe thing. We broke that on Monday morning. So our reporters, when there's loads of talks going on, we're ringing everyone. We're making maybe 30, 40 phone calls, because we can do that, because we have the time to do it. And hopefully, sometimes it doesn't, but hopefully for us, that delivers something unique. So we've been trying to bring the talks along as much as possible. but you have to be really careful not to push it too far. And I think some of the Sundays in particular have struggled a little in this regard with this latest one. So I find myself, when I'm doing the headline late at night, I've used edge closer to deal. I think I've used that twice. And I'm kind of, at this stage, you're kind of going, did we use that headline already? But we have been just kind of keep it going in stages. And I think the key is never to push it too far, because you can't take it back, you know, once you've written it. Yeah.
We're going to go back to the whole issue of kind of like, I mean, how social media has begun to shape the news as well later on. But I'm curious for all three of you, you know, like, who else is involved in the process? Like, you know, in newspapers, there's a conference, you know, is it something similar with Morning Ireland, with the journal? I assume it's an ongoing process all day. So who else feeds into it?
Yeah, no, we'd have a conference as well. So we, like, obviously I come from traditional newsrooms, so I know how they work. They're not going to necessarily work for rolling deadline the way we have. Our product is a good deal more sophisticated than it was when I first came into it, obviously. And we would have, like, some of the stuff Richie's talking about there, for sure. I think you quite rightly identify that people don't find online and longer, more in-depth reads exclusive of each other anymore. I think people are more sophisticated in their use of online. So we certainly about 2 years ago, I ripped apart the newsroom, and we have people working differently. So we have people working on the rolling news, breaking stuff. We might have 6 people working on that, going out to stories, hitting the phones there, trying to get stuff up, doing the Twitter and all that kind of stuff. We also then have people separately doing stuff for the scheduled list, which would be things that would be running at weekend, longer reads. We have one guy who's specifically dedicated to the fact checks that we've been doing. We, you know, would have carried an investigation there about 2 months ago about the charity sector and about what CEOs are getting paid now. That thing took a month and a half to compile, and it was a something like a 2,500 word thing, and had lots of bits.
So these are all stories.
So this is, so we would have a news conference every day, like any newsroom would have, like Morning Herald would have. So even 11 a.m. one in particular is the main one, because that's where a lot of the shifts collide. So we have everyone together, and that's about what's doing well on the site. So that would be about users setting the agenda to a certain extent. It would be what stories are out there that need follow-up, that people are asking us about, that aren't on our site, that we have to figure out another angle on. And then the third thing is about, obviously, what you bring to the table yourselves. So there's that kind of traditionally recognised news conference, I think. We do get, probably we're in quite a good position, where we get a lot of feedback simply because we have the facility through most people come to us through smartphones now, and we would have, you know, a particular button that allows you to send a tip and a direct email, so people have private things. The reporters would obviously be active on Twitter, but a lot of them now are such long-time users that they have Threema IDs and so on, so that people can send confidential information. So it's not a case of just tweeting at them random stuff. That fact check last night came from someone actually asking, is that true? Are there only 10 people there? And we had been talking about it until someone from outside said, is it true? We went, oh yeah, actually, we don't know. We'd better check. So our agenda is set, I'd say, in a few different ways. But the main thing is you still have to put the editorial framework on it, and we decide ultimately what goes on and what doesn't. And I think what will be a really interesting bit of this conversation later would be like the personal bias of journalists and editors, because I certainly am guilty of it. I know that.
So what are you guilty of then? What biases do you prefer?
Oh, look, I'm a feminist, and I'm probably a little left-leaning, right? And the journal would probably be towards that. I have to be careful that I don't always employ people who think like me. I certainly have 2 people in particular in the newsroom who are fantastic at hitting it back at me and challenging me on whether we should be covering something.
Over time, you can make them think like it.
I'm working on it. It's been three fucking years. And this guy, he just won't know any kidding.
Who are the refuseniks?
What?
Who are the refuseniks? Who are the ones who push back at you?
If I say that, they'd be delighted. So
exactly.
I'm not going to give them that. In a really great constructive way. It's a nice place to work. But there's that. Personal bias that I would probably admit within this room, but I mean, as a journalist, you do have to keep it out. Yeah, but I'm careful on my Twitter account, for example, on not expressing my views on abortion, simply because how can I stand up and say that the journal is giving, like, I have an opinion piece coming in from the Life Institute tomorrow, and they deserve a right to reply of something that we published in the last week. Now, my personal bias shouldn't come into that. It should be about whether we are given the full story or not. But I have to say, we are a little campaigning sometimes on things. When the Oireachtas Committee was sitting there about two and a half years ago, maybe it's three at this stage, we literally decided it wasn't something we used to do. We put a lot of resources into having someone cover that all the time. We ran 8 full days of, and we did it in 3 different ways. We did, at the end of the day, an analysis. We did bullet points for people who'd missed it. And then we did the full long live log every day of it. That was a huge amount of resource for us. Yes, it got read well, not amazing for what we put into it, but for us it was around, we really feel this is important. And also it gave us a few shout outs from Jerry Butterman, the Dáil, and things like that, which is nice from a branding purpose. Let's face it, we're commercial, we have to make a living here. So there's that. And then there's the other things. It's like most editors I've worked with are a tiny bit mad or eccentric because they have egos, because they get to that position, and I'm sure I have some weird foibles as well. But like, you know, the other day I was having a problem with a utility that surprised my energy and I was really pissed off, and then this tip came into our email about them ripping off customers in a very identifiable way, and I was like, get on that fucking story, nail those bastards to the wall. Yeah, anyway, we couldn't prove it, so we can't publish it. But so, like, you know, my editorial thing comes in, but I do have to say I probably pursued that a little more passionately.
Okay, so
yeah.
So what about, I mean,
it's completely opposite with us by law and by our statute and by the way we're established. RTE is. Yeah, well, we don't have the luxury of even having that option.
I've got the clock running now.
The only agenda that I was going to bring the RTE journalism guidelines with me as a prop, but I was afraid this is just like it's like I was leaning on them. But generally, RTE its mission, its stated mission, and its objective, and the reason we get license fee payment and all that, is to provide fair, impartial, accurate, trusted in news of interest of the in the public interest that is independent of any vested interest, be that a state body or a commercial interest. I don't. It's just, you know, we learn it in RTE school.
So, like, you know, there's never a case in Vincent, like, I mean, where, you know, as like Susan's just been kind of like saying, say regarding Energia, that something like that kind of bias comes
it's
to the fore.
Energia.
Oh, no, sorry. I thought I heard Energia. So a bias like that comes to the fore.
I'm an Everton fan, right? But if I'm doing a sports bulletin, I'm not going to put Everton at the top of every bulletin, right? Because I recognise that as a professional journalist, you've got to do it of what people are interested in, what's relevant to the audience, and not just what my own biases are. No, and I mean, to give you a little idea of the process of Morning Ireland, to get back to your original question, because one of the great things about Morning Ireland, one of the reasons I think why it's so successful, is it is a very big collaborative effort. So, for example, if I'm the day editor and I come in at around 1 o'clock or that, I start putting together a list of what are like, basically, you've got to try and figure out what tomorrow's stories are. If it's been on the 6-1, if it's been on the 9 o'clock news, if it's been on drive time, if it's been on prime time, it's no good to me tomorrow morning. So you've got to try and get ahead of that curve, which is more difficult than you think, I think. And so you've got to figure out what's going to be important tomorrow. Is it what's going to be happening tomorrow? And you start putting together a list of possibles, if you like. A team of reporters starts around 4 o'clock. Phone calls are being made. You're finding out who might be good to talk about this, who might be good to talk about that, what are people saying, all that kind of stuff. And then at around 8 o'clock or so, we have a conference call. The presenters from the next morning, the series editor, the tomorrow morning's editor, and the person who's been putting together the list. And at that stage, we decide, like, pretty much the guy who's on at night time has the say on it. Yeah. But if there's objections or no, we shouldn't do that, or what about this person, things can change at that. After that, it begins to get pretty much locked in. We do another conference call at 10 o'clock before that morning editor goes to bed, just to say what's changed or what's not, so there's no big surprises when they come in. And then when the morning editor comes in and takes over, of course, 2 or 3 stories get thrown out. There's something new in one of the newspapers that has to be picked up on. Something happened overnight in wherever. So it gets changed again in the morning. But it's very much a collaborative effort as to how it happens. And I think that cancels out a certain amount of bias. Now,
All these staff you have, like, how many people are you counting up there?
1, 2 on the conference call, 5.
Alright.
And, like, you know,
how many YouTube conferences?
We use a list system, so we use WhatsApp in the morning where we all kind of communicate with each other, just letting each other know, because we've a quite a small team. We've 200 reporters in London. I suppose that's a benefit to us in that they give us a kind of a global outlook, and we feel that there's a space in Ireland for a newspaper that looks outside of Ireland a lot more, and that's quite easy when you've got 200 journalists in London telling you what they think is important, and then we have 36 correspondents around the world. I don't know, like, you take the Joshua Malloy story, the guy who was dressed in rack. We broke that story, and the reason we broke that story is because we have a correspondent, Hannah Lucinda Smith, in Istanbul. And we also broke the story of when he was getting released. And again, that was because we can afford, being a big newspaper with world reach of having those, that kind of a luxury of a journalist seeing this. So we use lists, so I can see what London is planning throughout the day at any stage. They can see what I'm planning. I take a lot of their stuff. Obviously, they take some of ours. I can see what our guys in Scotland are planning, and I can see what's being fed in from the foreign correspondents through the wires. So we, because we're a small team, we would use a lot of technology. I find if we sit down for a meeting, I'd really, instead of having a meeting about things, I prefer just people to approach me during the day at all stages. So that's kind of how we would work it, I think.
Mm. I suppose it's worth talking about for those of you who don't work in the industry, like where the news stories actually come from. Yeah. People are always wondering, like, how do you come up with the news? You know, and it's not like we sit down there and come up with it. The number one thing, obviously, is events. If something unexpected happens suddenly and you just have to get on it, whether that's, you know, a bomb in Brussels, a famous person dying, a car slipping into the sea in Donegal, something happens and you have to try and bring that information to your audience. Then there's kind of things we know are going to happen, you know, like an election, the quarterly national accounts, the jobless figure, something we know is going to happen. There's the old adage that news is something that someone somewhere doesn't want you to know about. That's true, obviously. So you've got your team of correspondents and reporters investigating things and trying to come up with information. But it's also true that news is things that people do want you to know about. So you've got information that comes to you from official sources, from press releases, you know, the latest daft quarterly house price figures, the numbers of homeless provided by Focus Ireland. And so that comes to you. You get tip-offs from members of the public. You get stuff from your official sources like the guards or the fire services. Has there been a fire here? Or, you know, things have happened. And in RTÉ, similar to Richard, on a national basis, we're lucky that we have a network of regional correspondents. We've got a large newsroom with dedicated correspondents. So you'll have stories coming from, you know, Ingrid Miley on Industry Stories or David Murphy on Business or whatever. So then you get a kind of a broad range of these, and I've got international stories, of course, through wire services or whatever. So then you find out what's happening, and then you've got to decide, okay, tomorrow morning, how am I going to best tell this story? And the obvious way and the number one way and the one we always try is to go straight to the first-hand person, the person who it happened to, the person who saw it, the person who experienced it.
Okay, let's take that list of questions in that Vincent has called out there. He called out a lot of questions. There's industrial story, stories happening around the country, there's international stories. How do you decide, all three of you, given that list of questions, list of stories, how do you decide which ones lead?
Lead now. Take that? Yeah. Lead. Sure. Okay, lead. The most relevant to the most people in our audience. So, I mean, it's the most important, the most relevant to the most number of people. Domestic nearly always trumps international. Because
unless the international story involves an Irish
look, person. If it's a huge international story, of course, it's going to be the lead story, a bomb in Brussels or whatever. But generally, you know, something that happens here, you know, a car crash in England that five people are killed in, or a car crash in Tipperary that five people are killed in, you can see it's more relevant, it feels more personal to an Irish audience. So domestic is always bigger. Does that answer your question?
I have a look. We'd have quite a different take on it, actually, in the sense that certainly that has to be the case, because if I suppose people check into the journal quite a number of times a day, it works quite differently, I'd imagine, in the way that people use Richie's publication. And so if they have some inkling that something has happened somewhere, they go in. If it's not in the journal, we get yelled at in capital letters, because that's the way people yell at us. So yes, the most relevance most of the time, you know, to domestic audiences,
down the phone to
the
us.
Most people, you know. Mostly it's Vincent Murphy tweeting at me in block capitals. He's really rude, actually. He looks, seems really nice when you don't. But the other thing is that what we've actually found, and it may be the way online works, is that we'll often look at niche stories that may not be of appeal to everybody, but have, for that reason, possibly haven't been covered, or have been covered a bit, but in a very general way. I kind of wish I'd brought a slide, because a colleague of mine did this up once to explain it to somebody else, and it was a grid, and it was like... I'm trying to remember exactly how it worked out, but essentially what it was showing was that if you hit this, which is a subject which is only of relevance to a very specific group of people, and you only do a very specific tiny thing about it, then the effect is not very far-reaching. If you do a very general issue, and you do it really general fashion. It's not, he used actually cartoon things, POW and stuff like that, and like a knockout. So it looked better than I'm explaining it. And then he used, if you use a general issue and you go really deep on one tiny thing, then you've got a hit. Or if you go to a particular niche of people who have a particular issue they're passionate about, you better do a comprehensive job on that. And so that's kind of how we look at it. So a really old example from the journal, it just occurred to me there from ages back, and it takes in a lot of the elements that we work with probably quite a lot by circumstance, but now actually because it works for us, was a tip from a bunch of people. It kept coming in, we kind of ignored it because we didn't understand it. And it was the word fracking, and it sounds stupid to say we didn't quite understand it, but it didn't 4 years ago. 4.5 years ago. And I think the Sunday Times around that time, but possibly just after, because it was kicking off and it was in Leitrim. And we were like, what was this? And the first article we did in it was, what the hell is fracking? Because it was the question we actually were asking. And I was that ignorant, I didn't know. So we ended up doing that, but we ended up doing it as a series of things and we just kept with it. And that's actually what we do quite a lot in terms of agenda is, yeah, there's the event stuff, but we actually pick things as well that we know are of interest to people specifically are not being covered that way or at all elsewhere, because we can't compete with massive resources. But what we can compete in is delivering something online that people are just literally not seeing elsewhere when they go to search for it. Yep. And then, of course, it goes into how well you're doing and all that kind of stuff. But there are some things like that. So we started doing news series as well. You might have seen some of them. But we've created a thing now where we have a digital magazine that inserts into the journal where you go into it, so you can click into it and you open it and then you get a series of articles and multimedia about it. Yep. So we did one about lifers in Ireland, what that meant, where they're at, who's still there, can it be like this in future? We did it on homelessness, in which we targeted just before the budget 2 years ago, or not last year, but the year before, because of the threatened cuts to the homeless budget, and they added 50 million. I don't think that was down to us, but I think that impact held, and we did a few things around that. Just, it's funny, I think that there's no wrong way. It's just that we're serving a different need and a different audience to what Morning Ireland are forced to serve.
We're all actually very different, really.
In terms of the Times Ireland edition, you know, like they've explained, like, you know, that Vincent encapsulates where he's coming from. Susan kind of explained your side. You were saying kind of beforehand that you felt out of step when it came to kind of some covering the political stories in the last while. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, at one stage we were trying to do... we were trying not to do politics every day, so we were trying to get off politics splashes, mainly because when you then had a politics splash, you could go big on it and people would recognise, look, they're actually gone politics today, because that means there's been a development in politics. But we fell out of sync with all the other papers, because the other papers were trying to do the same. And what was happening was we were doing the politics splash on the day they were doing off politics, and they were doing it vice versa. And it was just kind of weird. Sometimes it worked out better for us, sometimes it worked out it better for them. For me, we do a list each day of stories that we have, and as we go through the day, I start moving the stories around in terms of where I think they are in terms of importance. And towards the end of the day, I'm left with two or three at the top, and one of those has got to be the splash. You know, you eliminate everything, and what you're left with, one of those, you've definitely got the splash with it. And the splash has to be big, it has to have lots of exciting features in it, and it's got to make people want to read it. Also, with us, the splash is all you see. So if I give it to Broadsheet or if I give it to Vincent Brown, that's it. We get one go of making people say, actually, you know, that sounds like a decent enough newspaper. So because we're kind of a centrist newspaper, slightly to the right, I'd imagine, we would always go, and we feel that our audience would appreciate politics a lot. So for us, a lot of the time, if we have a strong politics story, we will splash with that. But that's not always the case. London sometimes have very, very big international stories from war zones or whatever. We'll always use those. For me, a difference early on when the chances of life being found on Mars emerged, I put that story on the front of the Ireland edition because it was on the front of the UK edition. And the Irish newspapers had a story about the HSE the next day. And that, for me, was a nice difference for us to have. I'm not saying that's better. I'm just saying it was different. It's nice to be different in the marketplace. But sometimes you don't have a splash and it gets close, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and you need a splash. And you need to sit down and think then, what's likely to happen, what Vincent was talking about, doesn't it make sense that if this has happened today and that's happened yesterday, that the only alternative for, say, Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil is to do this tomorrow, or won't they rely on the independents to do X in return? And then you start hitting the phones looking for that angle. Sometimes you won't get it, and again, you can't force it. And then some days you just have a splash, and you know you've got the splash from about 11 o'clock, and all you really want is to get to the end of the day so as no one else has that splash. So yesterday, for example, I had JP McManus winning 17 million in a game of backgammon against an American executive, and the guy paying 5 million off that off. And some of this detail was out there, but the backgammon element and the new legal findings and the involvement of revenue in helping the Americans with the case wasn't there. So you're just dying, please don't let this break, please don't let this break till I can get it out in the morning. And then, like, that's a great story. Man wins 17 million playing board game. And then you add in the elements. It's JP McManus, he's a Limerick tycoon. And it was backgammon, which someone described to me as a game you play using all the bits of other games that no one wants. But I looked it up. I bought a book. I'm gonna learn backgammon. I'm gonna take him on. Me and JP.
Okay, yeah. I'm curious, because I mean, you mentioned, like, you know, you've all kind of mentioned international stories to an extent, and one of the kind of like movers behind this particular banter was the discussion we had in Syria, and people in the audience were incredibly incensed about like the lack of media coverage of Syria. You know instantly, Susan. You know instantly, Rishi, from your kind of figures, and Jane and Laura's probably tell you something. Are Irish people genuinely interested in international stories? I mean, or to them, is international stories more about life on Mars and that and that?
I think it's changing. Like, Ireland has changed a lot. Like, I remember when I was going over to London a lot at the beginning, when I was trying to plan this newspaper, and sometimes I'd be going over with some of the executives from our place and back and forward, and they were kind of saying, "Who's your target audience?" And I was saying, "The people on this plane, you know, the guys who have busy lifestyles, who see the world through London and outwards, business people, but not just them, but like." We kind of aim at students and people who just want to get a little bit extra. It's going to sound arrogant, but we try and build a product for people who want to be the smartest person in the room, not for the point of view of ramming it down people's throats, but for the point of view of life currency, having information that helps them solve problems in their lives.
So, is that international news?
That could be buying a bottle of wine,
yeah,
to knowing what your boss is talking about when he talks to you about Syria,
yeah,
and coming back to him with some vital information. We've had some extraordinary pieces from Syria. We've had photographers kidnapped and escaping. We've had reporters kidnapped and escaping. And their coverage is vital for people here to understand what's going on. So I do think Irish people are interested. I mean, they also want their Irish news, but I think more and more we have an understanding and this demand for a global outlook.
Do Morning Ireland listeners respond well to global news, Vincent?
I think so, yeah. I mean, one of the things that I suppose the differences between something like The Journal and Morning Ireland, like, I have probably 10 to 12 slots on my programme. That's all I can do. I can't do any more, you know? And whereas you can put as many stories as you want up in The Journal and just let people click on what they want, I have to make a call and say, these are what people will listen to. But yeah, I accept that maybe the coverage of Syria isn't as complete in the Irish media.
Syria's just an example.
But like, Syria is very difficult to cover. You've got a war zone where very few Western media are inside the country, so it's very hard to find out actually what's going on inside the country. And actually, a lot of the reporting in the Western world is based on this observing group in London, which is only a handful of people taking eyewitness accounts, and they may have their own biases as well. But then you've got the refugee crisis, which obviously we've regularly have people go over and into the camps in Lebanon to give an example of what's happening there. You've got the migrant crisis then that spawned from it in Greece. We've had Tony Connolly down there. We've had people, like, we were doing our best. We recognise it's probably the biggest story internationally for the moment. But there's only so many times you can have an analyst on from England to say this is what Assad needs to do, this is what the rebels need to do, or an analyst from wherever the analyst is based, Beirut or Washington or whatever. So, I mean, it's obviously a big story. We definitely keep close eye on it, and any significant development we'll try and get somebody on who can explain what the development was and what its significance in the overall picture was. But I would say, in the context of the 10 or 12 slots that I have to fill every day, maybe two or three international stories, unless something really big is there, is probably the
You can respond to this in terms of kind of like metrics.
Yeah, well, I mean, I thought you made an interesting point earlier, you're quite right, about Irish people being interested in international stories as long as there's an Irish element.
Yeah.
Or as long as there's an Irish impact. And I would add to that, as long as there's something they can empathise with. So Syria, I think, you know, people, once they started to receive pictorial sort of essays of what was happening in terms of families like yours, I mean, I think people were looking at powerful images of, you know, Homs before and after sort of things. Here was this street in this year, and this is this street in our most recent, which may be 2 years old, photograph. And people can suddenly realise what it must be like to have to rip your children from their home, stick all your stuff in a black bag and hope for the best, and fuck them out in a dinghy without a life jacket. Like, you know, it's this kind of stuff that makes you feel something. And the temptation is actually to try and just filter all international stories through that lens of sort of soft focus stuff. But you have to make people care about it in some way. And if that means being a little manipulative in your agenda, then that's what you kind of have to do. For us, I suppose we do have to worry about the metrics. But I do have to say that I suppose it might be to a little bit of our credit, and may not be as obvious on the journal, that we continue to cover stories that actually don't do well for us. And we bloody know it because we do have the metrics. One, for example, would be direct provision. Yeah. Now, that to me is almost an international story within our own boundaries. And people don't want to know about it, and people are cruel about it, and they think it's their own fault, anyone who's stuck in it, and we don't want to know. And there's this Cade Mead Fáilte bullshit that Ireland comes out with, and we, I presume everyone here, the fact you're here means you're engaged in news and in agenda and people and stuff. The vast majority of Irish people, they don't want to know. And so the fact that you have to still do these things and do the international stories, like, we have to make money, we have to get the clicks, we have to have advertisers realise that we're well read, so we can't have it wall to wall, the things we'd love to do. But there are ways of doing it, I think, to get people interested.
I mean, what's the drop off, like, I mean, Susan? Like, you know, I know you can't compare like with like, but like, is it a significant drop off in terms of clicks when it comes to international stories?
Oh, Jesus, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I mean, there's, like, if you go to the desktop version of the journal, which, like, maybe you probably will never do, but if you do happen to go on desktop at some point, have a look at the casualties, you can actually see them at the top, and you look in the international one there and have a look at the stories in there, and look at the views versus the stories in the Irish, or if you go into our 42 sports site, having a look at, like, you know, like wrestling, like MMA. Any of the MMA, etc.
Can I just say, I don't think we should be too hard on ourselves for that. It's the very same in every country all over the world. You're going to be more interested, as I said earlier, in stuff that's more close to home and more relevant to your own life. So I don't think we should be too hard on ourselves if fewer of us are clicking on that story. But again, with the public service remit that we have, we certainly would consider it very important that we keep big international stories in focus.
The important with world news as well is to have a mix. I mean, our world desk in London are very conscious of, they have all the big serious stories, but then they have a mix of lighter stuff and stuff then that's kind of humorous and would also kind of, you'd read it no matter what, no matter where it was, kind of thing. And that's important to have as well.
I mean, it's just very interesting because, I mean, like, you know, when we're talking about metrics there, I was looking at the metrics for, say, the Irish Times podcast, you know, and, like, the numbers are getting, and the one that's head and shoulders above everything else is Worldview. It's the work from the foreign desk, and it also struck me that, like, going back to what Susan was saying earlier on, that, you know, that sometimes you have to find a way into covering something that no one else is doing.
Yeah. And maybe that reflects as well that people just... world news is hard to follow daily basis, so people just maybe want a package that they can go to and just this is me, I'll know all my world news if I can get that. I think that's important.
Yeah, that goes back to that thing of delivering something that people can't find elsewhere, and the fact that it's in a podcast version, and in Ireland podcasts are not that developed yet, and the Irish Times have done a good job on that so far. I think that's possibly where they're going. An interesting online habit I forgot to mention in terms of international news we found is that people won't necessarily click in it, but they want to see the headline. in the river. They want to be happy it's there. They want to know that you're... And then they go, why haven't you done anything and anything recently? And I go, well, 3,000 people read it. Were you one of those the last time? But it, they kind of want to know it's there. They want to know you're doing it. Yeah. They just don't necessarily need to know anymore. By
And on so-called, like wordy issues, you mentioned direct provision there, or say, say like the housing crisis now. Every day I get a journalist saying to me, what about this story of the housing? And it's usually X more number of people have become homeless, or X person says they can't get homeless. And I try and push the journalist to say, where's the solution in this? How are we going to address this problem? Can you get someone to say, you know, this is how you can solve housing and move the issue on? A lot of the time in Ireland we dwell on this is the problem, this is the problem, this is the problem. And we don't give a lot of time to the debate of how do you fix this? So like in water, like people are complaining, charges are a problem. But very few times do you see in these stories people focusing or asking the question to the people complaining about the water charges, where do you get the money for to fix this problem? And I think that's something that I try and focus on in the newsroom and say to the journalists, look, all well and good doing stories about problems, but where's the solution within it? And let's move it on. Let's try and push that on. And I think if you do that with very serious issues, I think you can start. And that's why the direct provision became very interesting today when you had the judge coming out saying, look, there's X number of thousand people who've been here more than 5 years. Let's give them an amnesty. That's a really good story. Mm. You know, that's something you can get into. Yep. That's a concept and it's an idea that you can span out.
Yeah, Vincent.
No, just on the topic of trying to make people care about stories, you can't beat the first hand account. You can't beat going to the person who's in the middle of the situation that we're talking about. That's why, you know, you'll get on coverage of homeless stories. You'll always try and have someone who's really affected, someone who's living in the hotel, or when it's about hospital waiting lists, talk to the person who's been waiting a year to get that life saving drug. That makes it real for people, that's, whereas you talk in the abstract, it's very hard.
And that's your real strength.
And that's what radio can do in a way, really.
And also you have the listenership. So if I'm a minister and I want to reach a lot of people, well, Morning Ireland is a very, very good option, which is why for people like me, Morning Ireland is a must listen. Yeah. Well, I flick around, but...
The point... for everyone, surely. The point I'm trying to make is it's very easy and it would be very easy for us to just do a talking head from Focus Ireland and say this is what the solutions are, this is what the problem is, but what you got to do is find the people that are affected, make it real for the audience, and I think we do that.
You know, you actually have to do both. So I find that I don't mean that, but what I mean is that sometimes I find that the things that affect our readers and are most popular are not necessarily the things then that have most tangible impact on that issue. So the homelessness thing I mentioned earlier, just you brought that up, one of the most, I suppose, impactful thing we did in terms of reach and so on was something that was completely off platform, wasn't on the journal at all, but it was part of that series, where we went out, about four or five different porters went to different homeless shelters to kind of Cork Penny dinner type situations, and on the street as well, and went out with postcards. And we had questions filled out in advance just to about how long have you been homeless, what's your situation now, and then a second question, which was always different, from things like what is one thing that people don't know about you that you wish they did, to you know, what's the best moment you've had in the last week and stuff. And the questions were amazing. Like, one guy was like, or the answers were amazing. One guy was like, well, a very sexy lady said to me yesterday I was a very good-looking tramp. So that was one. And then there were some really eloquent, heartbreaking ones. But what we did then was we took them, scanned them all in, and set up a specific Journal Homeless account and just spent the whole week tweeting them. And they got taken up and retweeted by the likes of Dara Breen, but then also a WHO section on homelessness and dignity of housing for people, and so they got a huge international reach. But then that was the stuff then, so us doing that, yeah, it's a great idea, everyone was going, god, that's great, I really like that, but it was having somebody else pick it up who had the ability to set an agenda.
Yeah.
It was what brought it back to us and got mentioned to us in Leinster House. So other media have great power over other media, don't
they?
Totally,
but as you were talking, you know, I was also thinking that, like, I mean, do you think readers and listeners expect some element of campaigning to how you cover the news as well? I mean, not from you, but there still is an element in there, Vincent, you know? Like, you know, depending on certain stories might be covered. As in, like, you know, like the type of stories you're going to cover.
Oh, yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, you've got to decide what, you, as I said, you have 10 or 12 slots, and you have to make the call whether you do the story on the trolleys or do you do the story on the homelessness. Like, I mean, it's Sophie's choice, you know. Yeah. Both are worthy issues, but it's what does somebody have something new to say on it? How can we make this? Do we have some new or interesting way of making it relevant? You know, news is news, you know, right. So it's got to have something new in it. Right.
What about the campaigning element, Richie? Is that something that, you know, historically, the Times organisation, think back to Sunday Times, the stories they've done in the past, there has been an element of that. Is it something that informs you, your view in any way, shape or form?
Yeah. So, I mean, well, we have an editorial every day, an Irish editorial, and the views in that would be decided by everyone really pitching in, but mainly myself and the deputy editor, John Walsh, and he would write a lot of them. And they're the position of the paper, but they're also positions we would both hold to a large extent. We'd certainly argue them very strongly. And we've set out a lot of positions on things. So, for example, you take water charges. We think they're a good thing. We think you need a system for water. You need this money. And when we think you need money because you can't solve water and housing and all the other problems unless you're willing to get some kind of contribution for water. So we're strong on water. That's our position on that. And we will. That doesn't mean that we won't run news stories in which other people are saying the opposite of that. But we will hold that position in editorial. And I'm not afraid to kind of tweet some of that stuff if I feel it important.
Yes, yeah.
We look then as well at other issues. So take, for example, abortion. So we'd be quite a liberal newspaper. So Ellen Coyne, who's one of our young reporters, she's done a lot of stuff on abortion. She's done some very, very powerful pieces from case studies of people who've had to travel to London and bring babies back in the boot of their car to the cases in Northern Ireland. And she went on the abortion pill bus. And it's quite clear from her reporting. That doesn't mean we won't allow other people's views in. But again, we look at this situation where we've got an office in London. We talk to people in London. Our reporter's saying, what do you mean you can't get abortion in Ireland? What do you mean? And we feel that, you know, that regardless of the rights and wrongs, the moral argument, the fact is you can get an abortion in the UK. You can get on a boat. So the law in Ireland does not work. It doesn't stop people from having abortions. So we feel that this law doesn't work, and we don't, you know, so we obviously want to change, and we're looking at, you know, there's a push on from people to have a referendum on repeal of the eight. So we're not going to shy away from issues like that. We don't have to be neutral. We have a very loyal subscriber base, and our subscribers are members. You know, they can kind of connect with us because obviously they're paying for the privilege of connecting with us. And we feel that if we were going down the wrong track on anything, they wouldn't be long letting us know.
Right, okay. Just in terms of that campaign, do you want to add to that before I bring to close with the last question?
It's funny, I suppose one of the things that we would have set up the journal kind of ethos around was that we would be independent with a small I. Because, as we all know, independent with a capital I is not necessarily independent in Ireland. But we would very much be, of the idea that, I mean, we don't, for example, have an editorial the same way as you would have in newspapers and in Richie's online publication. But we have voices, the voices section instead, and that allows a platform for people to come in and give their side on both sides. I suppose we do, if we were to count them, I think our bias would probably tell there a little bit. Might be also just reflective, though, of the general sort of sense. So for the marriage equality thing, for one, like if you're even to think about that, we felt like we had a lot of discussion about that actually in the office because, of course, every one of us is completely pro it. But what are we doing? Because it's an actual referendum and people are meant to decide for themselves in that situation. We didn't want to be talking down to people. So we decided to try and be relatively neutral about it, but we were not going to give a disproportionate amount of time to one side over the other when it was clear from polls that people did not feel that this situation should continue. So we didn't give 50%. We weren't bound, like for Vincent is, we weren't bound to give 50%, so we didn't give 50% of the time. And it was there even in the choice of language. Marriage equality, I don't think, is the official title of the referendum. And we made a decision that that's what we would call it, although we were being constantly given out to by one side that that was not the actual way to refer to it. Okay. So it comes out. Yeah. It comes out.
One last question before we kind of take a break, and that's something that we alluded to earlier on. That's like, how much, like Richie, starting with you, how much has social media changed the news from where you sit? I mean, when you started out, like, I mean, there was no such thing as kind of social media as we know it now. Has it changed, like, I mean, how you work as an editor? Has it changed how you look at stories? And by social media now, I'm taking in the whole broad spectrum, not just likes of Twitter, Snapchat, Facebook, but also, like, I mean, comments and that sort of, like, I mean, reader engagement.
We have metrics, and I get a report on them, and I look in them. I look at them, and they do influence what way I'm thinking. And if a story is going well on social media, we're slightly different. We're almost anti-internet. Okay, we know it's there. We have a website, and we have a smartphone app, and then we have our tablet edition. But we don't have to update it during the day. So, and there's things that the internet have allowed newspapers to do that I don't think newspapers should have done. Just because the internet allows you to scramble up a story based on a tweet by Conor McGregor doesn't mean that you're serving journalism or serving a purpose in doing it. When I saw that Conor McGregor tweet, this is a glowing... That Conor McGregor tweet, for example, showed we've reached peak breaking news. The man issued an open-ended tweet and journalists rushed to write stories about it. When I started in journalism, I'm going to sound like an old man now. I just turned 40, but I'm not that old. When I started in journalism, my news editor would have said to me, get him on the phone and ask him what he means by it. Did any journalist do that? No. They rang his dad. They rang his trainer. They told you what his trainer tweeted. They speculated endlessly about it. And 2 days later, the people who revealed that it really was true, having spoken to his father and the local priest, revealed that he was back, and then they revealed that he was going to fight, and now they're revealing that he isn't going to fight. So is a journalist's job to run with social media and tell you what's being tweeted when most people actually follow Conor McGregor anyway, and you're just telling them something they're going to find out anyway? Or is it a journalist's job? When was it become a journalist's job to start speculating along with everyone else on social media? And when is it important that the journalist's job is to ask the question that gets the answer? And until then, you hold off writing it. And I think that Conor McGregor story, the amount of websites doing the exact same thing, but actually when you think about it, creating a whole heap of nothing, was fairly massive. And I am glad to say that I'm glad to say that I don't work for a company that goes along with that anymore. In London, we've switched from breaking news. We don't do it anymore, mainly because you can't compete with the likes of state-funded services like BBC and RTE. They do the breaking news better than we can do it because we can't afford to do it, just like them. So what they've done in London is said, why do people come to us? People come to us for analysis, for opinion, for insight, and for the big reads on the considered reads, curated reads, and packaged reads on big stories of the day. So what they've done in London now is they do 4 editions during the day, and I'm going to get the times wrong, but one's at 12 midnight, one's at 9 a.m., one's at 12 midday, and one's at 5 p.m. And what we're saying to people is, you don't need to spend your day constantly coming back to see the latest update. Just come to us at these set times and we will provide you what you need to know today. And if you think about it, that is completely anti-internet. And when we launched that, a load of people said, this doesn't make sense. I saw Alan Rusbridger recently said, at least the Times is trying something different. And I think it's time for journalists, all of us, to stand up to the internet and to say, just because you allow me get a 600-word piece up about Conor McGregor's thanks for the cheese tweet, I'm not falling for it. I'm not doing it.
But you see, I don't think, and Conor McGregor thing aside, a bit of a circus to be sure, right? But I don't think that saying because people are talking about something on social media, when take Twitter, the Twitter thing, because actually Twitter is, there's not actually the majority of people Twitter here. Facebook is the much more used one. But I suppose...
Only if you play by Facebook's rules. Like, we don't play by Facebook's rules. They want nothing to do with us.
Huh?
Facebook, only if
you
play
not you
by
guys.
Rules.
I mean the actual usage of the population environment, not followers or anything of things. But I think that I would take a little bit of issue with the idea that just because people are talking about it on Twitter or whatever, that it should be ignored necessarily. So, for example, I think there's a clever way into it. I think it is news if it's starting to shape the public perception about something. And that's where we came at it last night. It's only the most recent example in my head about the 10 TDs, this is what they're doing about mental health. It was about actually... this is actually, okay, we'll ignore it because it's obviously like they don't know how the Dáil works and people are actually coming in to read statements into the records. It's not debate. It's called a debate, but it's not actually a debate, technically. And so I think what we decided to do was, that's fine, we'd ignore it for a bit. And then it's like, oh, people are actually saying that this is a thing. And this is a little bit, this is not right. This is misinformation. And I guess it might be about what your organisation does. And our organisation is starting to much more, I think, and hopefully we're always developing. We're not perfect at any stage, of course. But our thing is about public perception and about feeling like we could be a trusted space. And we did it when there was a meme going around that Lewis drivers were earning the same as junior doctors. And there was a meme going around and we went through it. The bloody thing was so long I hardly got to the end of it when I was trying to edit it. And at the bottom of it, we had corrected the meme and said, please share this one because this one is correct. And that was not a fucking popular thing to do for people because the Lewis drivers are the demon at the moment. But that to me was important. And that was something that could have been ignored because everyone looked at that and went, oh, cheap shot, even if you don't agree with the Lewis drivers. But like to ignore it is actually not to do your job as a journalist, I think.
Mm. Well, I don't mean to ignore obvious stories from Twitter. I mean,
that wouldn't have been an obvious story because that was just like, oh, people are getting outraged again. Well, and so
I look at TweetDeck and I can see like patterns and stories that are emerging, and they do feed into the idea of, yeah, we better chase this up. Just so much as you're listening to the radio, you hear someone on, you think I better chase this up.
The conversation around
What I'm saying in terms of the example I gave of the Conor McGregor, it was a whole heap of nothing. And so much energy and journalistic endeavour went into that, you know, almost what could those journalists could have achieved if they weren't doing that?
Did you write, you should have written a great analysis piece afterwards, though, about the world of spin and MMA and stuff like that. That I would have read.
Well, we did no news story on that tweet. And we did no news story on the response, and we've done no news stories. We did do news stories about the MMA fighter.
Well, you see, the thing is, like, I mean,
every
time Conor McGregor is mentioned on a Banter podcast, listeners go to the roof, so I'm quite glad this. That was one story you missed while you were away, Vincent. Conor McGregor. I'm trying to remember how Morning Ireland covered it. Yeah. I think Descal covered it on the sports.
I'm trying to think how
eyebrows raised.
Yeah, I think I'm wondering how I can turn this into a story. Something like this. This Sunday Times editor said something about McGregor and Twitter went apeshit. Here's a headline, here's a picture of Richard who people click into, who is this guy? And then a couple of lines and then 12 embedded tweets on what people have said about it. Welcome to journalism 2016.
Is there a radio equivalent?
I can't think of it now. But I'll tell you what the problem is. Here's the problem. McGregor's thing, it's a bit of sports hype and it doesn't really matter too much. But let me give you an example. I'm going to go back maybe about a year and a half or so. Because I was editing that night on Morning Ireland and there was a bit of noise beginning on Twitter that there was some major protest going on outside a Garda station in North Dublin. Somebody had been arrested earlier in the day, brought to this Garda station, and there was reports that there were thousands of people outside the Garda station protesting, blocking traffic, all that kind of stuff, right? And, you know, people were retweeting it and people who were sympathetic to their cause were retweeting it in all parts of the country, and it was almost number one trending topic on Twitter. So call us old-fashioned, but we did what journalists do when we sent someone out to the scene. They didn't announce themselves, they kind of just went out to check it out. There was about a dozen people who had tweeted photographs of themselves, their friends were sharing it. Maybe their issue was a lot of people were sympathetic with, but the fact was there was about a dozen, maybe two dozen at most, people taking part in a protest outside the Garda station. And I'm not going to let you away with this, because the Journal had that as their top story on the site that night. The Irish Independent had the top story on the site that night. The story was massive protest in Coolock because this was what was trending on Twitter. One source, two tweets, whatever. No, go out and check.
You know what? We did
We didn't run a story.
We did actually go out and check, and then we put up, which is even more powerful because it plays in the place where the perception, and rightly so, you're pointing this out with us as well, began. We went out and we put vines up that showed exactly. So we didn't just say.
But the story
nothing.
Was up for a few hours while you were doing that, rather than waiting to check it out and then put it up.
Then we did go and put thing up, because we actually had a public representative as well who was saying that. So in some ways you're kind of putting egg on their face, not you, I mean,
yeah,
the whole doing of the thing. But the point is that we were then able to go, not just correcting ourselves, but correcting where it was happening by putting the vine up. So we can talk about it here and be self-righteous about it, or we can kind of go, okay, that's grand, but are you going to tackle it in your own organisation, which we are doing? Mm-hmm. And also then beyond that, for the public interest, is there a place to play there? And I think there is. That's what I'm trying to say.
While I'm having a go at you, I might as well do it once more in the friendliest possible way if I can. This is where
just bear in mind that the people outside there have been sitting. Some of the people outside there have been sitting on wooden chairs that we stole from a church for.
Maybe it'll tee up something that we can talk about in the later discussion. Because I kind of want to talk about clickbait, just for a little second. A few weeks ago on the 6-1 news, Martina Fitzgerald, our political correspondent, was standing there, and some young fella comes up behind her, and I don't know if I'm allowed to use a rude phrase on your podcast, but basically an incredibly misogynistic rude phrase was shouted, interrupted the broadcast, and it was nothing. Like 30 seconds later, Martina kept her cool, carried on with the report. But I knew straight away what was going to happen here, because that's clickbait. By the time the 6-1 had finished, Joe.ie, The Independent and The Journal all had a story written up around the idea of, you won't believe what this kid screamed at on RT 6-1 with a headline of what the phrase was. And, I mean, somewhere an editorial decision is made that that's a news story. In my line of work, that's just somebody annoying you. It's not a news story.
It doesn't matter, right?
Can I just make one more point before we finish?
Yeah, yeah.
And this is where I'm throwing the spotlight off you and back onto these nice
people. Because I'd like to come back.
It was the day that the Panama Papers had been published. And, you know, this is a 162 journalists in countries all over the world with years of research, with whistleblowers releasing the papers, all that kind of thing. And one of the wonderful things about the Journal is you can see how many people clicked on what. And the Panama Papers story had been running since the Irish Times had broken it that morning. And I checked the following morning, and the Panama story had less than 10,000 clicks. The Martina Fitzgerald story had 117,000 clicks. Yeah. Now, you're to blame as much as she is.
Well, I was going to say that's I'm obviously not doing each of the clicks myself, so you're quite right, and it actually just shows user behaviour as much as anything.
Yeah.
And look, you're quite right, and maybe I think differently about that piece going up, as I don't work there 24/7, I actually don't see every single thing that goes up. And as a woman, I would find maybe perhaps the repeating of that is degrading. I completely agree, right?
Just as a matter of interest, so, wasn't a male editor who made the decision to put that up?
No, it wasn't necessarily male or female. I actually don't know exactly who the last caller would have been. But I will come back on this, which is, it's very nice to come from the perch of a 10 or 12 slots and they all have to be super and everyone listens to it. But the Journal would have had lots of really good stories, and there was one in particular that was really important to us around children with autism. As an actual thing, this was happening. They were being locked in withdrawal rooms and left there for hours, to the point of like parents coming and their feet are bloodied because they kicked in the window and so on like that. We ended up starting press releasing stories like this, exclusives we had, including proof, photos and the whole lot, to Morning Ireland because, and I know Richie has a thing about this, what the papers say is still a thing. It's so archaic, as if news doesn't happen elsewhere.
So you put this headline up to all people to see this story?
No, I said this was a very important story, and it's one of many that we have press released. Like press releasing stories sounds ridiculous, but to Morning Ireland and to let editors know in advance the day before and giving them a view before it's actually published on the site, saying, guys, this is really like an exclusive, it's quite agenda setting, and the stuff then never getting in, and I was actually told, well, keep up the good work, but, you know, it's what the papers say. And then that story being used in what the papers say 2 days later when a paper does a write of it and obviously doesn't have a journal credit on it, and I've pointed that out and it's been ignored. And I'm not taking issue with you personally, Vincent, about that. It's just a systemic thing. But the point is that the agenda
is also relevant to the thing I was talking about because
it is around who sets the agenda and who's deciding what's what. I'm saying there's also very important stuff going up in the Journal, but that is being ignored by other media, possibly because it doesn't serve to say that stuff. There's a few things.
Like Susan said, and she addressed some of the points you made, but not all. But like just the point she made there, that Vincent, and this is also relevant to kind of Richie's organisation. Why does what says in the papers only deal still in newsprint?
Yeah, I mean,
you're the editor.
I'm one of the editors. That decision is probably above my pay grade. But I mean,
it's been brought up.
Look, this is something. Has it been brought up? This man is on the phone every second day to us. Yeah, it's something like the problem when you start broadening it is where do you stop and where do you start? It is and always has been. It says in the papers, and
it was 2016.
I accept that, and it might be something that would have to be reviewed. But
that's the only reason I brought it up is just because you personally turned around my organisation. Therefore, I have to say.
Oh yeah, no.
I have to say when morning. Absolutely,
neutral word for
I think we can neutral. Look, there's different models, and you guys have a model. And sometimes I look at the journalist and say, "Geez, that's a really good story." I've retweeted journal stories in the last week and stuff. Look, no matter how many journalists you have in a room, like so long as they've got phones, they're going to produce good stuff. I suppose the issue I just wanted to raise was there's people thinking at the moment, what does the internet let us to do? Right, let's do that. Let's do this. And you saw to an extent we had newspaper groups producing videos, and you might look at it's two guys in a football stadium talking about a match afterwards. The first guy asks a question that goes on for 2 minutes, and the second guy answers and it goes on for 6 minutes. It doesn't make for good TV because some other young fella is holding the camera. It's a little bit shaky. It's windy. The sound quality is poor. And you've got to ask yourself, you guys are print journalists. Do you really have to make that video just because the internet allows you to do it? And we had this question mark, and we said, do you know what? RTE make videos about news things that we're going to do. So we went to RTE and we said, any chance we could use your videos? And RTE said, yeah, pay us this amount of money and you can do it. And we've done that. And now we embed high quality videos with our product. We could make videos. I could stand a journalist out somewhere and get them to record this video. Are we adding to it just because it allows, are we adding to the story? No is the answer. And just because the internet allows you to do things, I think journalists, and it's not about rowing about each other, I think every journalist has to ask themselves, is what I'm doing worth it? And I think if a journalist sitting there who was basically rehashing Conor McGregor's tweet asked, what am I actually doing here apart from earning money and getting clicks? What am I actually achieving in this story? I think these are questions journalists need to ask themselves. How many clicks? Some newspapers are going to need clicks because that drives advertising, but I think we need to make sure that there are newspapers that don't need clicks to survive. And that's why, I suppose, we come at it from the point of view of, you know, please give us some money each week to help us.
Okay, I'm going to cut a break there because Conor McGregor is warming up outside. He's going to join us. He's going to join us in the Q&A part. But right now, we're going to take a break for 10 minutes.
Cheese in
please
my bag.
Give a round of applause to Richie, Vincent and Susan. So if you take... We take a 10-minute break, we're back at 5 to 8 and we get some questions from the audience then. Like you're going on about like 6-minute videos. I mean, this podcast is going to be running for 2 hours. Hi folks, welcome back to Banter. I did a little bit of market research there. Apparently the hard chairs are not as hard as I thought, so that's okay. So we got about 15 minutes or so for any questions from the audience. We covered a lot of ground in the first half. Some punches were thrown, some punches were defended. It was good roundy banter. It's great. Always great to have a rowdy banter coming back to Wigwam. So if anyone has any questions, put your hand up and shout. Yep, just down there.
Hi, I want to ask a question. It's kind of been touched on, but basically you talk a lot about giving the audience what you feel they should be interested in and also what they actually are interested in. I was curious how you decide, I suppose, where the bottom of the barrel is. There's an issue, obviously, around certain stories, like if you look at the tragedy of Volcrana, if you look at how that was covered in the Mail on Sunday, which I obviously completely disagree with, how do you decide, you know what, there's a side to this story people probably would read about, because we all have that macabre interest in tragedy and so on. How do you decide, you know what, we're not going to go there, even though people may read it, people might share it, but you know what, it's not in the public interest, it's not in the family's interest and so on.
Cool.
Do you decide, do you have like a list of sort of ethical guidelines, or is it more you make a judgment call, you know what, we're going to leave that.
That's rule three.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Susan, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. We actually do have within the organisation, we have internal handbooks, which are on Google sites, of course. They're not like paper because we don't like paper. Like Richie, we don't deal with paper anymore. And we do, for example, we would have very specific guidelines even about what we put out on social media, both on work accounts and on personal social media accounts as well, because I do think that the journal in particular, people are identifiable and are intertwined with their social media presence, and I think you need to be a little bit aware of that and how you present yourself. In terms of what's on the site, we have a news editor on at all times, so things do go through them. It's not a free-for-all. And so there is a lot of constant discussion, both within, like, shouting across the desk because we're not that big a company, but also on, like, we use an internal messaging Slack, constantly debating not just which stories, but exactly, as you're saying, how they go up. So, for example, something that we started doing more in the last few years is we pay for courts copy service with two different services covering a lot of the courts in Ireland, and we decide what stories go up and what don't. About 2 weeks ago, there was a particularly... It might have been 3 weeks ago, and it just sticks in my mind. It was a particularly vicious account of a sexual assault. And I saw that the same copy from these court services goes up to a whole load of different media, and we all pay for someone literally to be sitting there taking the story down the day. And I saw that one or two, certainly one broadsheet, their online arm, whacked it up as it was and certainly picked out the worst line to make the headline of. And I really, like, on my own personal, whatever they do, it's their own thing, I don't care. But we were reading it and we were like, no, that line's coming out, that line's coming out, and that line's coming out. And in some ways we actually had to go, are we censoring it for people? People are adults. But does it actually add to the sense of this case? Now, you needed to know that this was incredibly vicious because you had to understand the sentence, I think. But we felt like there was a point at which it was enough to give people the information they needed to understand. And our thing is always to try and help people understand stuff and context and things. But we felt there was a point at which it was just titillation. Mm-hmm. So we do have those it is not a set in stone because there's so many different case scenarios. Mm. All I can say is that it is really a day-to-day decision. It's a huge part, actually, of my job and of our news editors here as well, and the journalists there themselves. Right. It's trying to decide which is censoring.
Yeah.
And which
did
is...
Did you cover the Buncana Mail on Sunday story in any way, mention or anything like that? Yes or no?
I don't think we did. No, okay. Not that they had done it. No, okay. No.
Richie, what about you? Did you mention the Buncana Mail on Sunday story?
The Sunday Times, Mark Tighe did a story in which he gave a little bit more information about what actually happened. Now, I mean, I don't want to discuss a particular case. There's elements of that case that were wrong, and there's elements of it that have been slightly misreported and have been picked up on social media and things and are being driven as the key narrative. And I'm very conscious that the reporter in question hasn't really got a chance to respond. I mean, I think the Sunday Times spoke to someone close to the case and were able to get more details. But if you take that Buncrana incident, okay, you're not going to get... You'll ask once, you know, would the surviving mother be able to talk to us? If you get no, that's it. And I think in their case, there was a priest who was very clearly able to answer any media inquiries on behalf of the family. And that was fine. So we just spoke to that priest. So you will just you would ask once. And then if it's no, then that is it. And that's your boundary. And you won't go back. Also, you've got to ask, what's the end result of an interview like that going to be? I mean, there is only one thing that person can say, and it's obvious. So what are you going to gain from that point of view? And I think the more important story with Donegal was how come there wasn't, you know, safety procedures in place? How come you were able to drive onto the pier? How come the pier hadn't been? And that's the kind of the area that we looked at, and we pushed for like a review. And that's the kind of the story that we took on it. Doing our best to explain what happened as well. But I definitely think you need to take a step back and ask, you know, why are we doing this? Mm. And if the answer is we're not sure, well, you know, don't do it.
In terms of you, Vincent, this is where you kind of point to the book.
Sorry?
This is where you point to the book you forgot to bring you.
Yeah, exactly. We have, it's on the website. If you go to rt.ie and look for the About section, you'll find the policies and documents there. And one of those is the journalism guidelines that we work by. When it comes to privacy and issues like that, as Richie says, if the family doesn't consent to an interview, that's it. You respect their wishes. The Buncrana case was kind of unique as a story in the sense that there was a hero, there was the guy who swam out and he survived. There was another eyewitness who saw it, and actually reporters had access to all those people. On Morning Ireland, we had a particularly strong Morning Ireland, actually, the morning after that tragedy, because we had a reporter up there who got talking to the eyewitness, and then Tommy Gorman later actually made the request, and a brother, I think, of the mother did agree to talk to us and give us an interview to thank the guy who had rescued the baby and stuff. But after that, the family's wishes are always paramount. For example, you know, in a car crash or in a murder or anything like that, it's always our policy that the family should never find out from RTE, you know. So we wait until the guards say his name. Like, we might hear what the guy's name is or so, but we would wait until such point as where the guardies say we're releasing the name now because all the next of kin have been informed.
That's actually an interest. That's really hard, isn't it? Because that there's a real, and the one of the really bad sides, I guess, of social media is the pressure you come under, yeah. Particularly if you're like us and you play in that online area anyway, you kind of come under pressure. Like, everyone's talking about this and you guys still don't have a story up on it. What's the story?
Yeah.
I experienced it as far back as when Brian Lennon Jr. died, because Twitter killed him 3 times before he'd actually died. And each time we got a lot of shit for it. And the third time, you know, we got it from the secretary in his office, and then she said, I don't think all the family know, so we held off and we didn't put it up, even though we had the information, and then we put it up when we knew the family knew. But all that time we were being screamed at, which is a lot of pressure when we say that we listen to our users and we say we listen to social media, and there is a temptation sometimes to go, oh, fuck it, we know it's true, you can't defame a dead person anyway, let's just lash it up. The Boncrana thing, there was even an element in that where there was a lot of, at the start, who was the family? Do you remember? Because it was an unusual setting, because the mother was away, so everyone was like, but that woman is actually 14, so she can't be the mum of these kids. So, like, we sent one of our guys up to Donegal, and even though he'd kind of established early enough on what the situation was, we thought, Jesus, if people are only figuring that out now up there, does the mother even know? Has she been brought back and stuff? So we held off on quite a while for that. But again, the temptation is always, if we don't put it up first, I can guarantee you someone else will.
Yeah, of course.
So it's a really hard, I wouldn't say we always 100% get it right, but on stuff like that, we just don't think it's worth the shit we'll get for it if we put it up. Like, it's not just being good people and ethical journalists and all that kind of stuff. It's also, it actually comes back to bite you on the arse. Like, Mail on Sunday, like, whatever the rights and wrongs of it, is really bad for the brand, isn't it? Like, that kind of stuff is not going to hold
well. It's also worth saying, like, that like, journalism is a human enterprise. You know, we're all humans that do it. And, you know, we all know. You know whether it's right or wrong. You know yourself.
Yeah.
If a family doesn't want you near them,
but we read it, I think we are responsible as well. Like, my grandmother, unfortunately, buys that paper, and they had a whole spread. It was, like, second by second,
yeah,
what happened. Now, I know, I'm from Boncrana, like, a lot of people was not personally touched by it, but, you know, you are intrigued.
Of course.
How did this happen? How do I make sure this never happens to anyone I know? So you are interested in what happened.
And it's one of the most...
Second by 30 second of, like, what happened and who died and who floated to the surface. Mm. Like, I don't think...
Yeah, there was even a graphic, wasn't there, that they had done of the car going down. It was a bit distasteful.
I have to admit, I read it because I was morbidly fascinated.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is one of the horrible parts of journalism is when a tragedy happens and some journalist has to
knock
go up to the door and knock and say, you know, I'm really sorry, but we want to get it right. We don't want to get the name wrong. We don't want to get the age wrong. Do you have a picture? Would you mind if we showed a nice picture of your loved one who lost? A lot of the time, it's a really icky thing to do. But, you know, if you open the newspaper tomorrow and you see a photograph of the person who died in a car crash or in a tragedy overseas, wherever, someone had to go and make that knock on the door.
Or someone going to dig against their Facebook account. Next question.
Yep.
Yeah, just a question around, just it's related to a lot of those things you discussed, but just a bit, do you have a concern that there's a sort of a race to the bottom or declining standards? You've got the sort of, you know, the mob mentality, which sort of seems to drive a lot of stories, and people take what they see on Twitter as sort of gospel, and then there's pressure for eyeballs and all of those and clicks and all of that sort of stuff. So do you feel there's a declining standard? You're constantly trying to maintain your standards while also understanding that there's an audience there that is looking for information. Do you talk about the Daily Mail example, is there a sort of sense of decline in standards, or would you feel
do you mean decline in standards in terms of journalism or in terms of readers?
In terms of journalism, due to those sorts of pressures, the pressure to be first with a story and all of those.
Well, I'll answer this first, because we have a bit of luxury, of course, being funded by the license fee, that we aren't driven by ratings. They're important, of course.
We'd Jesus, like to I got press releases up to Wazoo today about Jane and Laura's left, right, centre.
We're very happy to have high listeners, but like when we're doing a story, it's not about can we get the most people listening to this. It's about, as I said earlier, getting an accurate.
I work for RT as well on that.
Well, you know all this then. No, but what I'm saying, I don't know. I sort of say, with my RT hat on, I don't feel under any bigger pressure on Morning Ireland. I think we try and do the same quality stuff as we always have. In journalism in general, I think, you know, the pressures are there, but there's always pressures on journalism, whether it's from the, you know, social media or from spin doctors, or there's always been pressure on journalists. That's part of the job. You take that, but you do your job professionally. But I don't work in that cold face.
Talk about it in general terms, Richie.
I'd have concerns. I mean, there's a wider spread of outlets. So there's more maybe doing more stuff, and then there's possibly some quality outlets still doing the quality, and then there's more doing less quality. And so maybe it can seem like there's a race to the bottom. But if you look at you know, sometimes you hear broadcasts say, oh, they don't break any stories anymore. I'm sorry. Lance Armstrong, FIFA, Rotherham, UK abuse. They're just ones from the Times, Panama Papers. They're all monumental acts of journalism. The thing that I despair about, and it worries me, is there's a disconnect between I want stuff free and I don't want to pay for it, but I want it to be good. You know, journalists aren't cheap. Running a newspaper isn't cheap. That's why we ask for funding, and that's why our promise back to people is we'll hire the best people we can. But you know, advertising now is moving away, so that's another thing that newspapers have to work out. How are we going to plug this gap that advertising was? And you know, you up the price of the print, or you up the price of your subscription, and all of a sudden you're losing subscribers. And it's a balancing act for us. And I think it's going through a bit of flux. I think it could diversify, and you could end up with luxury news paid for by a select number of people who really value it, and they are financing a team of concentrated journalists to produce news that they really need to benefit their lives, versus free news that other people who can't afford to pay for the luxury news are wanting to read, are happy to read. And there'll be a gulf there. And what worries me is up until now there hasn't been that kind of a gulf. Everyone's been capable of doing quality. And that's a concern. I mean, you look at take Lance Armstrong's story, for example. So we were sued by Lance Armstrong. Sunday Times was sued by Lance Armstrong, paid out a load of money, and had to, you know, keep going and fight that case. And legally, it cost an absolute fortune. And I'm not sure if they've got all that money back. But without a big, strong organisation, like now, look, the Times and the Sunday Times get things wrong. We make mistakes. But, you know, if it wasn't for the Times and the Sunday Times, Lance Armstrong would still be a 7-time champion. Andrew Wakefield would still be going around presenting false research on MMR. Children in Rotherham would still be being abused by the Asian gangs who were recently locked up. I mean, that's examples of journalism. And for me, that journalism is worth paying for. So it's more a question for you, the readers. What do you want? What does it really mean to you? And are you prepared to pay? I saw a tweet yesterday to Henry Winter, who the Times hired recently. And I don't know what Henry's on. I'm sure he's on good money. I'm sure we had to take him away from another newspaper to get him because we wanted the best football writer. And I saw someone tweet him yesterday, oh, my God, you're gone behind a paywall. Bye-bye, I'm not reading you anymore. Now, you either want quality soccer news, and the question is, do you want to pay for it? Or you're not going to get quality news. You know, Henry Winter came to us because obviously we have the money to pay and we get that through readers. So there's a question there for people. And I think I'm worried that the answer will be yes, there will be some people who want to pay for it, but they'll be small and they'll want a luxury product and they'll be willing to fund a small group of journalists providing them with exactly what they need. And I don't think that would benefit, you know, the wider public.
I think that there's a third way as well, because revenue models have diversified a little bit online. And I think that it might be a little bit simplistic to think that news can only be funded as in people are paying directly for that as a product necessarily, because we've certainly been trying to find a third way, because even in the 5 years that we've been in operation, how we're funding and our revenue model has changed dramatically. It initially would have been about clicks. You know, the word clickbait is used here and so on. It's kind of a dirty word, actually, despite some of the stuff that's gone up, and I agree that story is not good. But clickbait is actually damaging to our revenue model, because the user behavior of someone who comes in on a clickbait story is not that of a loyal user. And how brands buy media agent, they use media buying agencies, and they, you probably know this, but maybe other people don't. They operate for clients, and they go, well, you know what, we should take 10% of your online budget and use it with the journal this year, because they're attracting this particular type of audience. But it has actually diversified and changed now, and people are not looking for volume necessarily, which does go a little bit to what Richie's, towards what Richie's saying. They're actually coming increasingly to us looking for the habits of people, and they want loyal daily users. They don't want the big hits, because they are actually, they don't have a long tail for us. What happens is, if we can move people from coming in once a month because they saw something on social media and they click through to our mobile site on that, if we can get them in and show that there's quality product that is worth their eyeball every day. And because, you know, it actually isn't the case that all free things are made equal. If you look at your phone, there's probably 3 or 4 apps a day that you look at regularly. Mm. You don't check 50 different places. You use maybe Twitter as the app for that. We're trying to become one of those on your home screen, rather than you coming us to us through Twitter, where we have to strip ourselves half naked each time to tantalise you in. Not a great site anyway, but like we don't do it. So we do operate a slightly more sophisticated revenue model like that. And we're in the lucky position, though, where we've always played online. So we never had to worry about our advertising was falling away on a certain area. Therefore, we needed to get a big lump of money in. We've had to start very small anyway. So I guess we've just had to approach it from a different way.
But journalism funded by advertising alone, is journalism facing an inherent risk in that you are answered? You can't but help be influenced by your paymasters. If your only source of income is advertising, you are open to being under the influence of advertisers. That's just a fact of life.
And that's why we've set up the IAB in Ireland.
How come
it
took so long for people to realise Volkswagen were up to something dodgy with emissions? I wager a large amount of that had to do with the fact that Volkswagen advertise extensively throughout the world in newspapers, and you don't rock the boat or bite the hand that feeds you, more or less. So people also, there's a quality issue there. If you're prepared to only read journalism solely funded by advertising, you have got to ask yourself what's going on there in the background. Journalism that isn't funded only by advertising has a healthy position to be able to tell advertisers, get lost. Leave us alone. We're doing whatever.
But there's also an element there as well, Richie, that, like, I mean, like, you know, you talked about a third way. There's probably a fourth way. Like, I mean, when you may have a rich individual, I don't know, someone called Dennis or something like that, funding a newspaper, funding an organisation, then you're in a whole different situation, or Rupert or whoever it is. You know, then you're in a completely different situation. You know, I mean, like, you know, that's another set of kind of criteria.
But those days are gone. Like, I mean, the Times now has been told you have to make a profit, and it did so this year for the first time in X number of years. So there's a commercial reality for journalists, and it's okay, when you get to editor level, you're fully aware of it, because all of a sudden you have to balance the books. You've got a budget. You're running a team. People's jobs rely on your decisions in terms of what you do with your spending. So there is a commercial reality for newspapers. We're in the business of selling information, but the days of Rupert Murdoch sitting back and allowing the Times to make, you know, losses are gone. You know, you have to make profit. Dennis O'Brien, I mean, the Indo are doing well, as far as I understand at the moment, financially. But if the Indo Independent weren't doing well, there's only so long he'd hold on to it. You know, he's not going to keep it going forever.
Okay, time for one last question. Yep.
Can I ask you, give us an example of something that you've got wrong most recently, or something that you think we should have done much better on that? Something that you regret doing in the last while?
Very good question. The story you messed up on, the hit you thought was going to be a hit and it turned out to be a flop, something you got badly wrong, Susan. And don't say you got nothing wrong.
I would never say that. Like, honestly, I do think that we can be really have a lack of humility, might be a narrow way of putting it. I think, you know, I think it's kind of individual little decisions in the day that nip away at you. So when you mentioned the Martina Fitzgerald thing, I think you're right. I think when I was at home when that went up, I'm not disowning it because it's still on the site, because as far as I'm concerned, the decision was made. There was some merit to it. That guy has a, there was more to it actually on the journalist thing than that. That guy has actually a past record of doing this. He did it to, formerly of the Examiner, now UTV, Mary Regan. He did it to her before, which we were pointing out, and then the fact is, how come this guy's been allowed to do willingly security? Yeah. Also about that. But so, look, decisions like that, we're not always happy with exactly the headline that goes up. And then there's the kind of like, should we change it or should we not? I think as well, it was something that we talked about actually even today. I think we let the banking report slip, the guarantee report. That came out around the time of the election, and we were one of the ones banging on about it and, like, I suppose, responding a bit to the pressure of readers talking about people talking about, you know, nobody being jailed, the white collar thing and all that kind of stuff. And we kind of let ourselves get distracted by the horse race a little bit within the election. I think that's something that there's errors of omission as well.
Vincent?
Yeah, it's a tough one because, as Susan says, you know, we have a meeting directly after every single programme, and every time we say, well, that could have been done better, or this one, we should have done that, or, you know, so, like, almost daily there are things that you make mistakes on. And, like, I'm actually struggling to think of a big one off the top of my head, but like, you know, so sometimes we get caught up, as Susan was saying, in the kind of cycle of news and in the process, and you kind of miss a bigger picture. And sometimes I think one of the failings of our show sometimes is it is a certain format, and it's limited by that, and sometimes it would be nice to step back from it and have bigger picture analysis stuff, but maybe the format doesn't lend itself to that. I'm not sure.
Okay, so no mistakes in Morning Ireland.
That's not Richie. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if I have all the editions there, I'm sure if I flick through them I'd pick out particular ones. I mean, look, even the Times in London today, you know, they messed up last night. They didn't put Hillsborough on the front until they realised that that was on social media. A lot of people read a big conspiracy into that, and I'm not sure that's the thing. We've recently launched a new edition system, and you know, it had technically led to online editions, and I think there might have been a move away from that. Now, look, take or leave that. Look, by the second edition, they had corrected the mistake and they changed it, and they came out today and they said, look, we made a mistake. And John Widderow, who's the editor of the Times, he said that recently that the best thing about being in a daily instead of a Sunday is you get your 6 days a week to fix the mistake you made the day before. And I do think we get things wrong every day. There's stuff I look at and I say, look, we should have given that way more time. We should have done it differently. We should have got more voices into that. And I mean, you'd be mad not to. A lot of the time, it's hard to have the time to really sit back and look in that, because you're rushing on to the next day. Every morning you wake up, you're minus 20 stories. I'm minus 20 stories, and I'm literally having to find them in that day. So you struggle in that. But I think newspapers do have to hold their hands up. And maybe, you know, I often wonder sometimes, you see like discussion shows about media and stuff, and I'd love if they were a little bit, often they're kind of funny, jokey programs. I'd love if they were a little bit more serious. I'd love to get more feedback from people as to how we can create. I know during the boom years, people felt that the media got carried away with the boom years. That was interesting to see coming out. And I think it was interesting to see when the media were brought in front of the committee, they kind of bristled at these questions. And I think we should have a more open approach to that. And definitely, like, because we are going to make mistakes, and if you the harder you try to do a story, the more chance you have of making the mistake. So you have to be prepared to put your hands up. In Ireland, obviously, you've the second threat of libel, yeah, and you've a second time being hauled before the courts, and that's quite scary, as I've personal experience of. So successful personal experience of, but you know, nobody, you know, that's quite scary, and that's another thing that maybe the public. You need to, sometimes newspapers need the backing of the public.
The public don't understand that, Richie. You mean the public don't understand that? Like, I mean, there are individuals who use the fact that they can run to the courts as a reason to kind of like make journalists cower, make journalists try and back away from stories. And I really believe the public don't have a clue about that.
Well, people who are able to afford good lawyers can. They mightn't have a case, but they can certainly tie up your energy and your time for a while. So if we get in a legal letter, there's a process set in train where you have to go back over the entire story, investigate it. The reporter has to sit down. They have to write a file about what happened. So, or if there's a complaint to the ombudsman, all that picks off a procedure that takes time and energy. And if you have someone who's willing to fire off X number of solicitor's letters in your direction every time you mention them, well, then they're creating a lot of trouble for you.
Yeah, that reminds me, because there was something that I wish I had done differently, and I guess I can't be, because this is a podcast, right?
Yeah, but it is.
I can't be too specific. There's two, actually. One was where it was actually a proper reporting mistake. A clarification was not sought from a particular person about who she was included in the story. It wasn't necessarily about her. And if it had been, she wouldn't have been in that story. Now, it was rectified, and I think to, you know, happiness of everyone involved, but that was a mistake. And I can't, for legal reasons, say so. But the second thing involves legal letters that were fired my way while I was just about to go out on maternity leave, feeling like a bit rushed and felt the pressure, and was like, I'm being threatened to be put in jail here unless I take this thing down. Took it down for a day while we figured it out and got tons of legal advice, which we barely afford, and eventually realised we could put it back up. But I honestly had never come across the situation before. So I couldn't, I don't know that I would do anything differently now if I was back then, but if I knew then what I know now, I'd go, does that go on the podcast?
The fuck off goes on the podcast, yeah.
Okay. And kept it up, and I'm sorry we didn't, because in the end it went up anyway, but I'd love to have been one of those people who could have stuck to their guns. I just couldn't put the company at that big of a risk. And sometimes there's that as well. You want to be the brave editor who gets all the kudos, but sometimes you have to be a bit responsible as well about who you've got working under you, and in fact, you don't want your arse in jail.
Okay, excellent. Like I say, huge thanks to our three editors tonight. They've been fantastic. It's great to have them along. Thanks very much to Richie, to Vincent and Susan. Thank you all very much for coming out.
Thanks to Susan, Richie and Vincent for their time and contributions. This podcast was produced by Banter Series producer Tanya White. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate us and spread the word. Tell your friends about us, recommend us on your favourite social media network, leave a review or a rating on the iTunes store, and don't forget to subscribe. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news where we're up to at Banter, plus you can listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.